Welcome to today's event. We are waiting for our chairperson to arrive. Unfortunately, her technology has had a momentary wobble, and so we will begin today's event while we wait for her to arrive. My name is Megan Palmer. I'm the Central and Southeast Europe Programme Manager, and it is my great pleasure today to introduce our three speakers. We're joined by James Scher, who is the Senior Fellow of the Estonian Foreign Policy Institute at the ICDS. We're also joined by Kristina Gerasimov, who is Foreign Policy Advisor to the President of Moldova. And finally, we're joined by Julia Himrich, who is an associate here at LSE Ideas. So we will be hearing them speak on Eastern Ukraine, and Donbass in particular, on Transnistria and on Kosovo. And then we will enter into a question and answer section, which will include questions from the audience. And so I'd like first to offer the floor to James Scher. James.
Megan, thanks very much, and greetings, everyone, from Tallinn. Let me start with three contextual points about the conflict in the Donbas region. And first, about its character. As I think everyone in the audience will know, the events of 2014 touched off this huge discussion, expert and less expert, about hybrid war and what it is and what it is, what it means and what it doesn't mean. Very few picked up the essential point that the character of the war in Donbass is very similar to the character of irregular wars that Russia has been fighting for hundreds of years on its periphery. Wars that have involved state actors, but have also been network-based and included informal groupings and client states and so on. So if you look at this particular conflict, you will see, of course, in key positions, officers of the Russian FSB and GRU, and irregular forces. You will also see forces of the former servicemen of the former Ukrainian Berkut, special police, security forces of oligarchs, Cossacks, Chechens, various types of adventurers, criminals who were let out of jail and given arms, and of course, a lot of local people. And you look at all of that, it's very easy to forget that from the start, this conflict was instigated and directed, and the local forces commanded, trained, equipped, and financed by Russia. And this was admitted by a number of the local protagonists, including the first defense minister, Igor Girkin, who said, if our contingent from Crimea had not arrived on time, such resistance as there was here would have been wound up in days. So that's the first point of context. This type of war is meant to blur the distinction between an internal and an interstate war. The second point of context is that this conflict is the product of two Russian strategic failures. First, and principally, it marks the failure of more than 20 years of what then President Medvedev called the synchronization of the development of Russia and Ukrainian relations, closed quote, by peaceful but not necessarily pleasant means. And when Yanukovych was overthrown, that whole game came to an end. The second failure is that the initial effort to reestablish Novorossiya, the regions of Russia conquered by Catherine the Great, was a spectacular failure, launched on the spectacularly false assumption that Russian-speaking Ukrainians were or potentially could be loyal to the Russian state rather than the Ukrainian state. So what we have within the context of these two baleful Minsk Accords over the past 6 years now has been a different framework. and all the intricacies of Minsk, which is not a roadmap, it's really a maze, has diverted attention from the main point that for Moscow, the management of this local conflict has been instrumental to the main purpose, which is to secure, via this conflict and its proxies, a de jure role in the management of Ukraine's affairs with the West's consent. And I will now amplify that point by pointing out that initially neither President Poroshenko nor President Zelensky grasped it and got into serious trouble as a result. As some of you will recall, when Petro Poroshenko became president in the spring of 2014, he vowed that he would end this insurgency in 6 weeks. Well, he nearly ended it in 3 months because Ukraine's forces improvised in large part and to a large extent based on volunteers, actually had the insurgents by the end of the summer encircled and on the point of destruction. And he didn't, he actually assumed, Poroshenko, that he would get away with that. And of course he didn't, because at that point, Russia launched its combined armed maneuver groups into Ukraine and imposed a devastating defeat on Ukraine's arms. Well, Volodymyr Zelensky, when he became president, said, I will end the war in 6 months. Because he did not grasp Russia's fundamental aims either. And he assumed, and he was not alone, he had encouragement from Emmanuel Macron, that if you can establish the right atmosphere and you have the right sequence of confidence building and conciliation measures and disengagement zones and prisoner releases and all the rest of it, you will create an atmosphere and goodwill that will enable, make it possible to have a series of compromises that will gradually end this. Well, now he knows that is not so. And that is where we are now. And that creates a new situation because Ukraine under Zelensky has considerably raised its game. And that's going to lead to my last point, that the fact that 6 years after Minsk, we are still here and Ukraine, instead of collapsing and becoming ungovernable, is raising its game. Has now put the Russian leadership in a state of exasperation. And you can see this in a number of recent statements and actions by President Putin, Foreign Minister Lavrov, Margarita Simonyan from RT, who of course is a mouthpiece and spokesman, and all the calls which are now being generated in Donbass and being orchestrated for the outright annexation of Donbass into the Russian Federation. Take that as you will. But in his interview at the end of January, Lavrov issued to the Western Normandy partners, and he named them, France and Germany, what he described as an ultimatum, that if they do not force their protégés, call them Ukraine, to implement Minsk, of course, as Russia defines it, then Russia will do something else. Russia will step outside the accords and it will address the issue directly and it will raise the game itself without exactly specifying how. That is where we are, and there are two factors that add to it. Not only has Ukraine, in many ways, I do not have time to specify, raised its game over Donbass and created new baselines and positions, But as some of you will have noticed, Russia's long-term principal asset in Ukraine, personified by Viktor Medvedchuk, has now come under concerted attack by the Ukrainian authorities, and many of his principal economic assets have been seized. His media outlets have now been excluded from the media space, and he is under pressure from all fronts. And this comes at a point after months where the Russians have been investing even more in him than usual as a way of achieving, facilitating their objectives inside Ukraine, and they've run into this blanket defiance. And then there is the Biden administration. And Russia is now caught in a dilemma. Given the rhetorical pitch of the Biden administration, America is back, our values are strong, we are going to maintain our interests, we will not allow X, Y, and Z. Pure rhetoric, of course, through no fault of his own yet, not backed up by any indication of how this is to be done, there is a challenge and there is an enormous temptation on Russia's part, in my view, to test this administration, see exactly what its mettle is and whether they know what they're doing. You put all this together, there are a series of concerns, alarms, and opportunities for some kind of a dramatic escalation. And I think we need to consider that very carefully. And if we don't, there is a very good chance that we will, again, as we were in 2008 and in 2014, find ourselves completely surprised. And there I will leave it. Thank you. Is anybody
there? Thank you, James. And huge apologies to everybody for being so late. I don't know if you've all been introduced, have you? Did anybody introduce you, James?
Yes. Oh, yes. We've been very well treated.
Good.
Yes. So,
huge apologies.
Know who I am.
But luckily, I heard what James had to say, which was really, really interesting. And I'm looking forward to the discussion and asking him more questions. But before we do that, we're going to go next to Kristina Gerasimov, and she's going to talk to us about the conflict in Moldova. So, Kristina, over to you.
Thank you very much, Mary, and thank you to your team for the invitation to this event. I would like to make a disclaimer as I start that I will speak in my capacity as a researcher today rather than the foreign policy advisor to the president of Moldova, Maia Sandu, and I hope that is fine with you. And before we talk about the current state of play today in the Transnistrian conflict, allow me please to explain what happens in the region with a bit of a historical context to this, because the Transnistrian conflict is not the same as the conflict in the Donbas. It's not that much visible. So I think there is need for a little bit of a historical context. So as I've mentioned, this particular conflict hardly attracts any attention, both in Europe and also beyond. But it's important to say that since the 1990s, it's been a dangerously silent conflict that has been keeping Moldova stagnating, both politically but also economically. Even though no violence is currently taking place, the unresolved issue poses really considerable threat to the stability, not only of the country, but also to the security in the region in case of a potential escalation. So the situation there is far from stable. It is a considerable obstacle to the development and prosperity of the country. As I mentioned, it creates numerous complications for the people to be able to focus smoothly on the consolidation of the country's statehood, working on good governance issues and strengthening the economy. Since the early 1990s, the pro-Russian separatists have controlled this region, They draw very much on the support they get from various rent-seeking schemes, such as smuggling, where economic groups, but also political elites, from Transnistrian region, from Moldova, from Ukraine, from Russia benefit from. They also draw on the support of the Russian troops stationed in the region during Soviet times, which have never been withdrawn. For centuries, however, it is very important to know, people with very different ethnic and linguistic backgrounds have lived on this territory, as well as Romanian-speaking majority. There are minorities who speak Ukrainian, who speak Russian on this territory. However, in 1991, with the dissolution, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the country's new independence from Russia, as well as the infused fears about Moldova possibly reuniting with Romania in those years, was not welcomed by everyone. So in the Transnistrian region, we saw an insurgency in 92, where more than 1,000 people died. There was a peace agreement that put an end to fighting. However, with the support of the Russian troops, the separatist authorities have been able to retain control of the region ever since. So to wrap up on this part, we talk about approximately 300,000 residents in this territory. There are huge corruption and smuggling going on of cigarettes, of alcohol, of other goods. They make fortunes on smuggling. This is a completely closed political system. There is no free media, no competitive party system, no fair and competitive elections. There are Russian troops on this territory in two forms. One is a peacekeeping battalion, another one is a military base, which is illegal. In total, we're talking about 1,300 people there. Economically also, Transnistria, however, is very much dependent also on the EU. With the introduction of the DCFTA, which takes most of their exports, but politically they're part of a different ideological space. We see evidence of rampant anti-Western propaganda there as the ordinary state of play. So if we speak about the major divisions or obstacles in 2021, even after 30 years, there is still no consensus, you know, here on how the parties to the conflict see the settlement process, how they envision their integration of this territory, and how do they see the status for Transnistria. Another obstacle is who are the actual parties or the veto players in this conflict? Who does Chisinau speak with in order to really, you know, look for a sustainable solution to this question? Is it Tiraspol, is it Kremlin, or is it both? If we speak about the current priorities in the Transnistrian conflict settlement process, I think we're really talking about trying to fight the consequences of the epidemic that had a huge impact to how the two banks of the River Dnistru are interacting on a daily basis. And here we talk about, you know, from the reopening of the schools subordinated to the Ministry of Education and Culture and Research, the access to the agricultural lands in the Dubasar district, but also, you know, the proper insurance of free movement of people, of goods, which has been severely restricted since COVID restrictions were imposed in March of last year to manage the COVID-19 pandemic, according to the authorities in Tiraspol. This has been strengthened with multiplication of checkpoints for the flow of people, goods, and means of transport. It is true that at the end of January, Tiraspol decided to reduce the quarantine posts, but there was no specification of when this is exactly going to take place. So from this perspective, this is still a major obstacle in terms of dealing with the free circulation of people. If we talk about the main voices, the decision makers or the major players in this region, we have to mention, of course, the OSCE, which facilitates the three-tier negotiation process for a very comprehensive and hopefully a lasting political settlement to the conflict. The negotiations format is 5+2, which includes here Moldova and Transnistria as the two sides. Then it's the OSCE, the Russian Federation, and Ukraine as the three mediators. And then we have the EU and the US as observers. Since the meeting of in this format in Berlin in 2016, we saw that the sides agreed upon specific confidence building measures, which make up the Berlin Plus package. And we see certain progress there, but also on certain dimensions, less on the on strengthening the political dialogue between between Tiraspol and Chișinău. This is the big framework. If we look at the main, if we look at the active players, I would say, of course, we have Chișinău, Tiraspol, and Moscow. Ukraine is interested in having, of course, a stable situation at its borders, but I think Transnistria is by far not a priority, considering the domestic environment and its own conflict on its own territory. Same for Europe, the security in the region is driven by the security developments in neighboring countries, and in Ukraine and in Romania. The Eastern Partnership more broadly has not been, as we've seen, a stable region. Therefore, the Transnistrian conflict at the moment is not a priority for either of the major players in the region. So to add here, there is not always a full overlap between the main decision makers in the conflict settlement process and the major players, if I can make this difference. This hinders also significantly the settlement process. I will briefly touch upon the perspective for the settlement conflict from the Moldovan side here. The governments in Chișinău have not really had a comprehensive state policy on resolving the Transnistrian conflict. But the way how it is seen now is that the road to conflict resolution is through a stronger, richer, and much less corrupt Moldova. So the best investment is really to support Moldova to become an attractive alternative to Transnistria reality, both economically, politically, and socially. Therefore, I think there is this drive to move systematically but carefully towards reintegration by consolidating Moldova first, its statehood, its economy, but in the same time to increase the links with Transnistria, be they from a business perspective, political perspective, media, civil society. So basically gradually starting to rebuild the country. The OSCE, of course, is the key partner for Moldova here in resolving the conflict as a mediator, but also in providing the necessary assistance and expertise to the authorities on everything that is related from human rights to rule of law. Russia and the key Western players continue to favor the status quo over any revolutionary changes, which is good. At the same time, in these circumstances, local actors can continue to benefit from various rent-seeking schemes that go beyond the radar. So to conclude here, it's fair to say that the conflict is not really frozen, though from the post-Soviet space, maybe this is the most silent one. COVID has worsened things last year, and we do not see any changes there. With the lack of a functioning government today in Chișinău and with a not really functioning parliament, the situation is quite volatile. There is still no common vision in Chișinău among the various political actors and the decision makers as to how to reintegrate the country. And on the last note, the international community is really key here to helping this process. I will stop here, and I'm more than glad to tackle any remaining questions that I was asked to cover in this 8 minutes, but I didn't manage to.
Hello, thank you very much, Christina, and we will come back to you in the questions. But before we do that, I'm going to hand over to Julia to talk not about post-Soviet space, but certainly about post-communist space, Kosovo. So over to you, Julia.
Thank you, Mary.
Yeah, great to be here. And I look forward to the discussion later. We have a lot to cover. I hope everyone is okay keeping track of all the different actors and all the different places we're talking about. As Mary said, I'll be discussing the Western Balkans and Kosovo specifically. And what I would like to do is to give you a little bit of an overview of the changes that I think that in the last few months and year might have, what kind of impact they might have now in the near future, because actually a lot has happened on Kosovo, despite the pandemic. And I think the changes that we'll see, that we've seen, will bring out these misconceptions that some, you know, that are prevalent in the in Western Europe and in the United States when it actually comes to the conflict in Kosovo and how it should be approached. But before I start, I don't want to give you a historical overview. Some of you will be experts in Kosovo, some won't really know the case that much. So you all have, the good thing of being online is you can Google if you need to look something up. But just to highlight 2 points is, two dates, I would say specifically, is 1999. Many of you will remember it, some of you won't be, won't have been born by then, but it was the actually military conflict between Serbia and Kosovo, and specifically the Kosovo Liberation Army at the time, followed by the NATO intervention, which was a military intervention, of course, and that was followed by an international administration led by the UN of Kosovo, UNMIK, that is actually still in the country. But then the other date is 2008, which is when Kosovo declared independence from Serbia. And this is why Kosovo is kind of included here in this event, because that's why many people would refer to it as a frozen conflict still, because even though Kosovo declared independence, Serbia did not recognize that independence. And so Kosovo is a contested state. That means it does have recognition. It has 117th international recognition, but the UN Security Council is divided about its statehood. Russia and China don't recognize it. Within the EU, we have 5 states that don't recognize it. And so Kosovo is not a UN member, but it does act quite a lot like a state. So it's a bit in this limbo, and it has been there since 2008. And I think it's fair to say that few people were expecting this to continue until, 13 years later. The declaration, the Independence Day actually just passed a couple of weeks ago. And so, a lot has happened in those 13 years in the region, but also globally. A lot of has changed when it comes to the relationship between the superpowers, how the EU has developed, and also, of course, the relationship between Kosovo and Serbia. And I just want, because we don't have that much time, I just want to highlight a few things. I think the United States, the changes in the United States with the Biden administration, James mentioned, and the administration as well earlier, I think it will have an impact also on the situation in Kosovo. You have changes within the EU and how it has approached the conflict. And you have significant changes in Kosovo, actually, with the election, political changes domestically that will reshape how the international community will be able to engage with the conflict. And I'll just briefly talk about those points. So in regards to the United States is incredibly important for Kosovo. There wouldn't be an independent Kosovo, or it wouldn't have been a declaration of independence without the United States, without the George W. Bush administration that really pushed this and was able to get quite a lot of international support, even though it wasn't enough to get the Security Council on board. But at the same time, the US, even though it's been very important because of what happened in the 90s in the region, it has been retreating from the region. And under Obama, we've certainly seen a handover kind of to the EU to be leading on the international involvement in the Balkans. Then you've had the era of Trump, which brought a lot of insecurity and unclarity when it comes also to the Western Balkans. I don't have time to go into the attempt the Trump administration has made to broker a deal. That was a very awkward situation in DC last year. But that was also due to the ambiguous relationship that we had between Trump and Putin. That was just not that clarity about what the US was actually, how they wanted to approach Russia in the region. And what we see now is Biden, that James referred to it earlier, that this declaration, we're back, we're going back to basics, back to what our original values. And I understand that that is obviously for many, then of course the question is, okay, so what does that actually look like? I think already in the case of Kosovo, the fact that Joe Biden has said that he's committed to the independence of Kosovo and wants Serbia to recognize Kosovo and wants Serbia and Kosovo to join together the European Union eventually, which is basically the US position before Trump, is already quite a lot of clarity that we didn't have in the last 4 years in regards to the region. And that will also affect how the EU will approach this, I believe, because we've seen the EU also wobble a little bit when it comes to its approach to Kosovo. I think in 2008, there was a hype around putting a big civilian mission, ULEX, into Kosovo, a lot of hope what the EU could achieve, still some hope that EU enlargement would happen eventually. And this idea that the conflict between Kosovo and Serbia could be overcome through European integration, the same way after the Second World War. That has just not proven to be the case. And there have been different issues. The EU-led dialogue between Pristina and Belgrade has been running since 2011. And there was some success in how that started. Some agreements were reached. But there was quite a lot of issue around implementation, and also the process was politicized, not just in Serbia and in Kosovo, but actually also by the member states, because it became entangled in the idea of EU enlargement, it became entangled into the question of migration in Europe, and suddenly member states, even those that recognized Kosovo, were becoming involved and were trying to withhold the kind of incentives that were supposed to encourage Kosovo and Serbia to participate in this process, and that has led to quite a lot of disappointment when it comes to EU enlargement and the prospects for Kosovo and Serbia. And there's also been a change in kind of this approach about European integration as the fixer for everything. We've seen the EU suddenly jumping to ideas of land swap that came up a couple of years ago that was quite popular here in the UK, the idea of swapping territories between Serbia and Kosovo to appease them. But other member states, especially Germany, was very much against it within the Commission. It wasn't exactly sure where it stood because Mogherini suddenly, who was the high representative for the EU at the time, suddenly seemed interested. So it wasn't clear at the end of the Juncker Commission where the EU was actually going with this, considering also that there wasn't that much progress on the ground between actually getting them to talk to each other in through the dialogue. So the EU, the push for any kind of indication from the US that they are supporting an EU process is definitely a good thing. But I think what the big change, obviously, that we will see now is the change in government in Kosovo. So we now have a new government led by the Vetëbendosje movement, which means self-determination in Albanian, and is a movement that has been developing over many years. It was quite controversial in the beginning for international actors. The Europeans were actually all very hesitant to get involved with them because they saw them as too radical, potentially violent, too nationalistic. And they had, you know, established good relationships with the existing elite, the political elite that had also been nurtured by the European Union or the international community. And but this movement continued to grow, and mainly because of dissatisfaction with how the country was run, about the rising corruption. And they managed to win the election last year and to establish a coalition that fell apart. But now there was a new election again, and they've been able to create a coalition. And it is, still an anti-establishment movement, I would say. But what is really striking is that it started as a youth, kind of youth and protest movement, but has really been able to get support from the wider population. And if we also need to keep in mind that Hashim Thaçi has actually been indicted now and is in The Hague. And he was obviously representative of this former elite, this political elite that was very popular now in London, Berlin, Brussels, and DC. But even though he's been indicted a few years ago, that would have created a huge uproar domestically, but that hasn't happened. And also in this election, we've seen that Vetëbendosje succeed still. So I don't want to go too much into detail now. I just want to say that also, just to cover Serbia as well, but Serbia is obviously quite an interesting position now, because if you think of it, in 2008, and we've mentioned 2008 a few times now, Serbia was the bad guy, the one that rained on everyone's parade, that didn't recognize Kosovo and the conflict, that didn't end the conflict. But it actually established itself as a good ally or friend in Berlin or Brussels in these negotiations, Vučić particularly managed to get quite a lot of recognition. But and the Trump administration, this ambiguity with Russia definitely helped Vučić as well. And it's something that Vučić likes to play with. He likes to play the good friend of the Europeans, and Serbia is committed to EU integration. But on the other hand, he also keeps, you know, an open door to Russia. And obviously now with the vaccination, we've seen a lot of influence from Russia and China as well in Serbia. But this is likely to change now. If there is, in fact, going to be more pressure by the Biden administration on recognition, and the EU will try to lean on that as well, the situation for Serbia might change, and it'll be interesting to see how that develops. I do think I've done now my 8 minutes, so I don't want to take too much time. And
yeah, I've been very bad about looking at my watch, so... but thank you, that was really interesting and potentially rather hopeful, actually, in contrast to the two post-Soviet space conflicts. I think the idea is that we will have a little discussion among ourselves before we answer the very many interesting questions. And I was trying to think of a question that I'd like to address to all of you, because these are very similar conflicts. And they are, I think, as I was planning to say at the beginning, rather than frozen, they're festering. They change, they mutate, and particularly the ones in post-Soviet space are quite worrying at the present, I would have said. So I think maybe I will start with James and Christina, and then come to talk about Kosovo. So in the case of James and Christina, I would like you to think about the similarities between these two conflicts, and what do you think is behind the Russian role? Is it about geopolitics, as the Russians claim, or is it about preserving oligarchic relations, or is it about preventing democracy? Do you two feel like speculating on these issues? James, I can see you want to say something.
It should not be a controversial point, because the Russians say it themselves. Russia is a revisionist power. It is opposed on matters of principle and interest to the European security order as it was codified after the Cold War. And you cannot separate either of these conflicts from Russia's broader interests and outlook in Europe as a whole. And that even enlarges upon the original point I made, that the conflict in Donbas is not about Donbas for Russia, it's about Ukraine. Ukraine for Russia is of vital importance because most of the regime in Russia and all those who are bound into it do genuinely see Ukraine as part of the Russian homeland, and they feel that what happens there cannot be completely separated from what happens in Russia. And when you add to that these fundamental feelings of identity, this European dimension, and this overall perspective of geopolitical antagonism, which again the Russians will officially say, is, they don't use the term values very often, they say it is a civilizational difference as well as a straightforward geopolitical difference. You could see then, you know, just how strong these interests are and how deeply rooted this is. And Christina can contradict me, but I personally, watching from a bit from afar, have never viewed events in Transnistria, Pridnestrovia, being simply about that. It's about Moldova, and it's again about its relationship with Europe. And Valery Litskaya, who Christina knows well, we had a 2-hour discussion one day in Tiraspol. And we didn't have to discuss this because it was, you know, for him, this is absolutely obvious. We had no disagreement here. So,
Christina, would you make a similar analysis? Oh, you're muted, Christina.
You're muted.
Sorry about that. Again, yeah. From the perspective of a researcher, what I would like to start with is your question, what are the similarities or the differences here? I think, obviously, there is only somewhat the two conflicts are only somewhat similar, but they're more different than similar. It's clear that the violent part, at least for Transnistria, took place in a very different geopolitical environment in the early 1990s from what we've witnessed in 2014 and onwards. The geopolitics in Europe were very different, also viewed from Brussels, but also viewed from Moscow. Also, the Russia-EU relations were very different in the two periods. And I think that has also put a different frame to the two conflicts. The main a similarity that I would say is that the main causes of the two conflicts, and here I, in a way, share James's assessment, they're not domestic. While it's true that on these territories there are various ethnic, linguistic groups that reside, and oftentimes they have been framed as if these are inter-ethnic conflicts, it is obvious that these have not started because of these differences or because of the hatred that exists among the different groups living on these territories. About Russia, I think if we analyze the foreign policy documents, it's very clear from the very start, from the early 1990s, that Russia's interests in its near abroad have always been made clear, also in terms of how they see, how it's seen, how the paths of development of these countries are seen. And we also, if we look at the different dynamics between be it Ukraine, Russia, or Moldova, Russia, we do see that when their perspective on their country development does not fit with what Russia sees as the development of the region, we do see these tensions in various formats, including developments in the two conflict regions. I'll stop here.
Yeah, I mean, I can see, it does seem to me there's more similarities than differences. I mean, if one brought in the Transcaucasus, where the conflicts were also in the early 90s, certainly, it seems as though these conflicts are a way of, in a way, preserving instability, which I think is really important. But what I was wondering in both cases, James talked about Ukraine raising its game, and I wondered what he really meant by that. But I wonder how far people at a local level are able to withstand some of these pressures. And that's also, I'll come to Kosovo in a minute, because I think it's really relevant to what Julia was telling us about the new politics in Kosovo. I was very struck. I mean, you mentioned the failure in Nova, whatever it was called, southern Ukraine, Novorossiya. When I visited the area, I was very struck at the way people I met were extremely proud of their role in thwarting the efforts to create Novorossiya. And the idea that if you have a very substantial civil society, you can resist these kinds of things. And certainly in Ukraine, I've been very struck by the hugely active civil society you observe in Ukraine. So I wonder if you both say something about the sort of civil society developments in Ukraine and Moldova and what they might mean for the conflict. And James might say what he means by raising his game.
Okay, I'll do raising game first. Zelensky said, came as a complete surprise to Putin, who was very uncomfortable. He said, you want to have local elections in the Donetsk and Luhansk republics? Fine. So let's include the 1.6 million people who have fled those areas and are now living in far better circumstances in Ukraine itself. And then the Ukrainian delegation even started to include representatives from those people in the trilateral contact group. Now the principal representative there, former president Kravchuk, has said, the days are over when you can shoot at us and we will just turn the other cheek, we're going to shoot back. So in all these areas, there's a different kind of temperature now. The bigger question that ties me with Kristina was the civil society aspect, and it's come up a lot. In Ukraine, you could always, before 2014, you could count on a fairly solid majority of people who were in favor of joining the EU. You could count on 25 to 30% who were in favor of joining NATO, either soon or eventually, more eventually. And as you went east, these proportions sort of changed. It was never the case, even in the conflict areas at any time, with all the various people measuring opinions in very professional ways, that you came close to a majority of people anywhere in Ukraine who either wanted to exit Ukraine, join Russia, or become completely autonomous. But there were very strong minorities, still minorities, in favor of some type of federal state rather than a unitary state. Now, what happened after 2014 is that all these variations in opinion, they were preserved, but the proportions became radically different. And even by the end of 2014, only 20% of Ukrainians polled said they saw this conflict as a civil war, which is very interesting. Now, since then, what's happened? People have become tired and exhausted. They've become manipulated. And then there is a second factor, that the Ukrainian authorities, as they so often do, have failed to grasp these opportunities. And so even outside the conflict zone, in the parts of Donbas and the Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts, which either never were incorporated into this, or which were then liberated from it, the Ukrainian authorities have done so little that people there are deeply fatalistic, depressed, disaffected. So Ukraine has not somehow, this is its major failing of the state, raised its game in Ukraine itself. Yeah. And that has been the problem for 25 years. So I'll leave it to Kristina now.
Thank you, James. And if I may just continue on, you know, reflecting a bit on the Moldovan side, how this is seen from a civil society perspective, but also the role of civil society perspective. I think for too many years, the Transnistrian conflict has not been a priority just because of the political stalemate in terms of finding a viable and sustainable solution for it. Therefore, the civil society organizations have stepped in at various points in time for, you know, to promote some kind of trust building confidence measures. But at the same time, they raised very much the alarm about the human rights violations, particularly last year as well, also about the role that the OSCE plays in the conflict settlement, about, you know, this need to form a vision for conflict settlement that the authorities are oftentimes lagging behind. If we look at the polling, though, in terms of how important the conflict is to the citizens and how they do see the conflict settlement process here. You know, I would have to say that James's appraisal of what happens in Ukraine is very advanced to what happens in Moldova. Transnistria has not really been a priority or a concern for the Moldovans in terms of what's going on there or how do they see the reintegration of this territory. However, it's very much also linked to, you know, the in a way to the geopolitical views that Moldova is still really much, you know, separated. But it's difficult to really have clear evidence because polling is not really done in Moldova on Transnistria on how this is perceived. Plus, it's something that you know, to really have a good perspective of the understanding of civil society would have to also poll the basically 1/4 of the population that left the country and whose views are really not reflected in any of the national polls here.
Ooh. Hello, thank you. Do you want to come back, James, on this?
Yeah, very quickly to make a very obvious point that I missed. Civil society is a very powerful factor in Ukraine. It has been for an extremely long time, because in part because the state functions so badly, and a lot of confidence has grown up. I was in Kyiv during a big blizzard in January 2013, and the authorities were doing nothing, but suddenly everybody emerged, set up committees, were organizing transport, organizing bringing tea and food to old ladies isolated in various places, and the whole thing just took over. Well, the same thing happened on a much bigger scale after Crimea. And, you know, this is a very powerful factor, and I think it sets Ukraine apart from a number of its neighbors.
Thank you. And now, finally, Julia, I'm sorry I left you to the last, but I'd love to know whether there are certain similarities just in the situation of small statelets that somehow have ambiguous statuses. But I guess the difference is the absence of Russia, but does Serbia play the same role as Russia? Might be the question. And to what extent, has geopolitics affected the situation in Kosovo and in the region of the Balkans?
Obviously geopolitics plays an important role. And I think it's interesting to see how it's evolved over those now 2 decades or more, right? So it was a very, if you think of it, in 1999, there was a very different relationship between the US and Russia than we have now, that we had in 2008. So in 1999, there was, you know, that the intervention was even possible, you know, to the extent that it was. I don't think that would be necessarily possible in the same way today. In 2008, I think there was generally a surprise among lots of European states how much Russia suddenly got involved. And obviously the timing was particularly bad for Kosovo to do that in 2008, just as things were also kicking off in Ukraine. So it's kind of, Kosovo has always been affected by bigger geopolitical questions. And quickly, they just come, as soon as there is a conflict or there is an opportunity for geopolitics to come in, that is done by different actors. So Serbia is always happy to do that. They said earlier they are very good at playing between Brussels and Russia whenever it's convenient. But, you know, there have been lots of international actors now active in the Western Balkans that previously weren't interested, just because of this idea of being able to stabilize or, you know, to get involved, because the EU has not been really moving forward on the promises that it's made before. And this idea that the Western Balkans are inevitably going to be part of the European Union is always going being put into question now. And that's, if you asked in 2003, that everyone would have said, no, of course, all of them will be, all the states in the Western Balkans will become part and of the EU. And that's been kind of, that certainty has been lost. So I think it's made it even more vulnerable for the coming years for geopolitics to play a role when anyone decides that they want that to happen. And so I think also Trump kind of showed that he was trying to make it geopolitical thing, but that didn't really work out because there wasn't the strategic thinking behind it. But it is, there's definitely a risk as soon as there is no certainty for the statehood or for the future of the region and whether they join the EU or not.
I ought to turn to the questions from the audience. I just wanted to add one other issue, which I think is particularly important for Kosovo. So I'll address it to you, although I think it's relevant for the others. But because we've got so many other questions coming up, I'm not going to ask them to answer it, which is, how important are economic factors in all this? I mean, is this what propelled this new politics that you were talking about in Kosovo?
I think the economic stagnation in Kosovo is really serious. It's really a fact because there is a very large young population. It's affected people. You have young people that are very educated, very interested in Europe, in traveling abroad, and just also the visa issue, the fact that they're not, their grandparents in Yugoslavia had more freedom of movement than they have now. And so it's just really hard to accept. And there, of course, huge economic aspects of that. And that is really what has been driving Vet Vendosi and why it took so long. I think it took a long time for external actors to understand that that's what they were about, because they would look at Kosovo always in the Kosovo-Serbia conflict and not beyond that.
But at the same time, you might argue that it's deeply entrenched in the very nature of the conflict, and that maybe up until this new politics, I don't know whether the new politics will change it, but I just feel oligarchic politics where so much of the money gets siphoned off is absolutely key. It's what allows these states to become permanently stagnant.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would say that necessarily they had an interest, that the Kosovo leadership had an interest in, having a stagnated Kosovo. But I think the progress that was being made was good enough for them at that point that they didn't see a need to push any further. I think that's maybe a, generous interpretation, but it's kind of a, they were getting quite a lot of it out of it, how Kosovo was developing in the region, but it just wasn't, shared with the wider population.
Well, we have a question from a name from somebody called Botan Kendi Kurti, which sounds to me as though he's from Kosovo or her, but I don't know. And so, but on the other hand, it's a question about Russia. And the question is, what are the primary reasons behind the EU and more importantly NATO not taking significant steps against Russian expansionism aside from sanctions? And I suppose that was what to be one of my key questions to James. What do we do to prevent the annexation of the Donbass when we see so little happened after the annexation of Crimea? Shall I, although I won't go to James first, I'll go to Julia first.
But maybe I would pass.
Maybe you don't want to answer that question because it's about Russia rather than Serbia. So shall I go to Christina first?
Sure, I could try and talk a bit about, why the EU doesn't take a stronger or bolder stance on the Russian expansionism. I think if we look at, what happened in Belarus and what happened in Nagorno-Karabakh, for instance, and how the EU reacted to the developments there, I think it is clear that in a way the EU doesn't have always the appropriate tools to immediately respond in a manner where it's efficient and effective. So this would be one aspect of why we see not always the reaction we'd like to see. Of course, the EU is not a single voice it's a collective voice, and the various interests within the union make it, as a bureaucratic machine, very slow, both in terms of developing new tools, but also to reacting to these various crises that keep on popping up in the post-Soviet space. I would refer to that. At the same time, I think obviously if we move to the economic part of that sustains these conflicts, I think it's important to say that this is actually key, at least for the Transnistrian conflict. It is perpetuated very much by the economic stakes in the region that various regional elites have here. And I have already talked about the smuggling that takes place, but this is only minor in terms of various other rent-seeking schemes, where not only oligarchs have high stakes, but also their children or their immediate also relatives are also involved in various schemes. So this really prolongs the way of how this conflict could be settled from, getting rid of this economic dimension. At the same time, I have to mention that since the DCFTA was made available to SMEs from the Transnistrian region, that has had a very positive impact in terms that it has brought the economic actors a bit closer in terms of standardizing their products for the EU markets. And I think this has an indirect effect by bringing the economy in this region, at least the clean one, closer and more integrated to the EU standards. And I think I think this is a powerful tool to bridge the gap that exists between the left and the right bank on the river Dnistru. Stop here.
You said they didn't have the right tools. What do you think would be the right tools?
Well, we know always that the security dimension, or an extension of the security dimension that would allow the EU to be bolder, has always been a reason for the lack of consensus. So we never saw among even the big EU powers a consensus on how much involvement on hard security issues should the EU have in the region. So from this perspective, I would say that the tools that would allow the EU to promptly react on everything from violations of human rights in the actual war zones to diversification of the peacekeeping missions that exist in certain of these frozen conflicts.
Yeah, it's really hard, isn't it? Because the EU isn't a hard security actor. I mean, should NATO be putting tanks into Ukraine on the border with Donbass? James?
First of all, as far as the EU and Ukraine, the reality check has to be that whoever has been in power in Ukraine, the determinant actors in Ukraine have been at least a dozen financial industrial groups, so-called oligarchs. And whereas in Russia, the state has exerted mastery over all of these people, in Ukraine, that is not the case. So that is a limiting factor to Ukraine's closeness and eventual membership of the EU. Now, as far as NATO, what the Russians understand is the West is divided, not just today, but by definition. And today they don't seem to be very worried that the Biden administration is going to be able to do much about that. So I could sit in this swivel chair and pretend that we were not divided and think of ways to strengthen deterrence. It's not difficult, but the good news is that there is a measure of deterrence now. And it's not just sanctions, and it's not just the threat of more sanctions. If Novorossiya had succeeded, if the Ukrainian armed forces collapsed, I have no doubt that the entire security position in all of Central and Eastern Europe would be far more shaky and far more insecure than it is now. But it didn't. And although the Russians know, yes, if we do our stuff, we will defeat the Ukrainian armed forces again, they know it's going to cost them a lot. And they know that, and they then have to think, well, what happens next? What do we do with the country? Because the point is that even when Ukraine is down and out, it doesn't submit. So there's a measure of deterrence now. And the practical question, we don't have time to go into, this is a seminar in itself. How do you strengthen it? How do you strengthen the views in Russia that an escalation is going to be very hazardous for you and take you beyond your level of risk, your comfort with risk, assure you at the same time that the more this goes on, the more the costs are going to mount up and the more other core interests of yours are going to come under pressure. That's our practical challenge. And if Biden and co. want to be a game changer, they're going to have to get beyond the rhetoric and understand very realistically who they are dealing with, how serious they are, and do a rigorous assessment of what can be done. I hope that is starting, but I don't know.
Julia, what do you think the EU should be doing in relation to Kosovo?
Oh, in relation to Kosovo, well, yeah, there's plenty to do. I think there's, there are lots of different aspects. Like I said, you know, it's not just about the dialogue between Belgrade and Pristina. And I think it is important to bring that back, make that, you know, the driving force, and to make that more, you know, more accessible for the population, both in Serbia and Kosovo, so they understand what is actually being discussed, how it's being, you know, how this could affect their lives, because so far it's been quite a distant process, but also to engage more communities in this dialogue. So far it's been always very, you know, elite-led, and it's been, so far the Serbian minority has never really been part of any kind of international negotiation, and that's obviously incredibly hard to get them involved. But there needs to be some kind of sense of how can you get more communities involved in this kind of, in this dialogue. And then I do think that the EU absolutely needs to, you know, deliver on its promises, and that the EU enlargement just needs to become more realistic, more immediate, and there have to be tangible results, especially, for example, when it comes to visas and traveling. And integrating the region in a meaningful way, because, you know, people don't care about the different about the acquis and what is being opened and what is being closed, and it's been a very long time. So there needs to be much more of an understanding in Brussels how how on the ground, and this is not just for Kosovo, it's for the whole region. Like, that's the thing, you can't see Kosovo just as a, you know, outside of what's happening in the rest of the region. And that's why I was saying earlier, Biden being, you know, having a very clear line helps, but the EU really needs to sort itself out and having like a clearer strategy. And I mean, that's also where, you know, I didn't mention that earlier, but Brexit is a shame, because the UK was quite an important actor. They are still very interested in having the Balkans join the EU, but it's obviously a difficult sell now. So it's, there's plenty to do. I think clarity would be appreciated, especially from the bigger member states that should really know better.
I agree. Okay, the second question from the public, from Dana Van Nieuwal, who is Youth Education and Society of Utrecht from University in the Netherlands. In which ways are the conflicts in the countries, the ones we've been talking about, I assume, visible in citizenship behavior among national citizens? And do you see a difference in this between different generations and age groups? And I know James is keen to answer it, but I will, if we, yeah, we've got time, I will ask you all to answer it because it's a general question. So we'll start with James.
I think, to be fair to Dana, that I largely answered it.
Actually, I thought you had, so but you didn't talk about the generational difference.
Generational difference is a tricky one. There's one factor that creates a positive generational difference, and that is the new economy in Ukraine, which has been stimulated by many of that 1.5 million who have come out of Donetsk. And even in areas that are run by very corrupt establishments like Kharkiv, there's a lot of new economic activity going on. It's very impressive, and it manages to elude a lot of the, you know, the usual machinery that stagnates everything. So young people, I think, are much more, as they are in many other places, proactive, confident in themselves, and all the rest of it. So that's the only new element I'd add to what I said earlier.
Do you want to answer that? Then shall we go to Julia next? I'm just trying to jump you around a little bit.
Shall I go next? Maybe I can just briefly speak about the generational change, but it's because I'm not sure I would be the best person to comment on the whole question. But I think what is striking is that if you compare Kosovo and Serbia, I would say that there is, of course, on both sides, as always in conflict, these kind of notions of the conflict get passed down and people live with them. And even though you might not have experienced the conflict yourself, there's certain notions that you still inherit from other generations. But I do think there is a different approach with younger generations in Kosovo that are maybe a bit more pragmatic because they have to be about it in a way that this is really about how will my life change if, we do get statehood. While in Serbia, I think this is also, the privilege if you have statehood, that is really a privilege that you have and you don't have to engage with that question to the same extent. And for many young people, they've never been to Kosovo, but they still have very strong feelings about it. And those are rarely very different from older generations. So I think I'm not saying that Kosovans are not nationalistic or that they're not very patriotic, but I think they've grown up with having to quest of being challenged about the statehood all the time. And they realize that, having the statehood would really change a lot for them. Well, for a Serbian person, Kosovo becoming independent or not being independent could eventually change their life depending on, EU enlargement, but what does that actually look like is quite difficult to gauge. So I think it's a different approach in that sense. But I wouldn't want to go too much into the question now because I also haven't been to Kosovo in the last year, obviously, because of that.
And do you want to add anything, Christina?
Not really. I think I covered this in the previous round. But
yeah, I think so too. In fact, I asked the same question, really, didn't I? There was a question that you wanted to answer, which I haven't got the question, but it says that there's the question on the Russian Orthodox Church and Ukrainian autocephalous church is one that I would like to answer. What was the question?
The question was, what is the significance of Ukrainian autocephaly? And I'm going to try to give a 20-second answer, despite the fact that I've written 45 pages about it. The Russian Orthodox Church has been one of Russia's principal means of influence in Ukraine over an extremely long period of time in this very religiously pluralistic country, which in fact always had two Orthodox patriarchs since independent, well, really, and three, because there's always been an older Ukrainian autocephalous church. And without going into any of this, the fact that the ecumenical patriarch in Constantinople finally granted autocephaly to Russia, to the church in Ukraine, was an utter shock. And it wouldn't have happened without the war. Because what happened in the war, many of the Russian Orthodox clerics overtly supported the insurgents. Some even boasted about participating. Girkin, who I mentioned earlier, even boasted about the number of people in his own security entourage who were clerics, who were carrying Kalashnikovs and using them. What was the result? An exodus from Russian Orthodox parishes into the parishes of the what had been the smaller Ukrainian patriarchate of the Orthodox Church. And what did the Russians do? Putin? He immediately convened a meeting of the Russian Federation Security Council. So someone says, how do you know that the Russian Orthodox Church is a political and security instrument? There's your answer. And they have been trying to roll this back on many different fronts, so far without success, and I don't think they will succeed in rolling it back. So it matters.
That's really interesting. Thank you. Now, we have another question from Hugo Marquez, who says, which again relates to a lot of what we've been discussing. After the recent diplomatic failure between the European Union and Russia, I mean, I assume, Hugo, that you're referring to the Navalny business and Lavrov's Borrell's embarrassment. What would be the consequence of that failure for possible integration of Ukraine in the EU and peacemaking in the region? Oh, gosh, I didn't mean to give another question immediately to James, but he is the obvious person.
I couldn't help laughing because I just when you mentioned Borrell, I just wanted to say I was embarrassed, and I certainly hope he was embarrassed. Is that really a new question? Well, it is in a way a new question. I mean, it is and it isn't. Even back in 2008, before the Russia-Georgia war started, I very emphatically expressed the view, which I could more emphatically express now. The Russians really don't have any respect for what we call Europe. Because they've lost a sense that we can really threaten anything which is fundamental to them, or offer anything that's fundamental to them, or really get our act together. And what we enjoy doing, which is lecturing to them about values and all of the rest of it, just provokes undifferentiated indignation and contempt. The fact that we have people all over Europe and the West now talking about truly draconian sanctions in response to the arrest of Navalny, who incidentally is a figure I admire profoundly. But we're not doing this after the obliteration of Aleppo, after almost 50% of Syria's own citizens had to relocate either in Syria or flee the country. After again, 1.5 million people in Ukraine had to flee after all Ukraine's maritime assets and land assets were seized. We weren't talking about these things then, but we're talking about them now in response to Navalny. And whatever we think about it is largely a domestic matter. Can you be surprised that the Russians have difficulty, the Kremlin has difficulty taking us seriously? And it's my one reservation about Biden, that he's talking about values too much. There needs to be a fundamental discussion, reacquaintance with our basic interests, in which values obviously play a role. But there are other things as well. Hard-knuckled security issues. Last point, and I will be quiet. I was in the room when someone I won't mention, but let's say he is as senior as you could get in Russian foreign policy terms, said in 2014, when they were very confident and they had the bit between their teeth, Moldova and the Baltic states should watch events in Ukraine and draw their own conclusions. Because the Russians understand we have large Russian-speaking communities there who they, for their own reasons, connect with the Russian state and see as potentially loyal to them. And they are raising that parallel. So, you know, this is a matter of hard security for us. This is not all about values. There is a potential threat there, which can be addressed by a variety of means. And I'm not talking about tanks crossing borders. These are straw man arguments. Sorry, I probably said more than you wanted me to say.
No, it was very, very interesting. I think we've just got time. Well, I wonder, because our last question is about the role of trade, which actually you've really talked about. So I just wonder if the three of you would like to just give a short, if there are other points that we haven't raised that have come up that you'd like to add to. Julia?
Sorry, did you say if I just now to close wanted to add another point that I haven't?
Yes.
Yes, I mean, maybe I would just add something that I was thinking about earlier that I didn't mention, was that obviously with Vendozia, because your initial response to my opening remarks was, oh, that sounds all very positive.
Optimistic, yes. And I was going to ask you about the answer surely to the conflict is that politics have to change in both Serbia and Kosovo.
Yes, and I think there are certain risks that come with these changes as well, because potentially they're just all, you know, going into very different directions. If Serbia, you know, getting Serbia and Vendozia to talk to Vendozia is not going to be easy. And also, you know, there were some concerns about how Vendozia is approaching it in terms of maybe being too much of an Albanian-led nationalist movement. How good are they going to be in getting minorities on board and actually being inclusive when, you know, the whole self-determination language could potentially be very exclusive for certain parts of the population, and if it's too alienating to get Serbia on board. So it's... And the other question is, how is the EU going to manage to get Serbia engaged in a constructive manner where, you know, so far in Serbian circles, it was always assumed, yeah, we'll recognize Kosovo once we know we're joining the EU. It would be the last, you know, box ticking exercise we do, but we'll hold on to that, obviously, until the end. I think there's a sense now we need to get to that point a bit earlier, but to get there, it's much more... A much deeper engagement of the conflict has to happen from all. And it's obviously everyone has a lot on their plate right now. So it will be a difficult task. So, yeah, I am optimistic that some things change. That's obviously good, but I'm not.
And I do agree with you about this point, which I hope the EU are more responsive to, about the real need not to just do a top-down talks, but to involve local communities to a much greater degree in a more formal sense. I mean, there are lots of people doing, you know, what they call second track or going to Mitrovica or whatever. But I think more community involvement could be very important. Mm. So, Christina, what would you like to add?
Maybe one thing on also the generational differences from within these territories. I think it's very important to not forget that in Donbas we'll have children who will go to school this year or next year who have never experienced full Ukraine in the sense that they never lived in a united Ukraine. Same in Transnistria, there are generations, new generations of young people who have not experienced what it's like to be part of these countries. And they have a very different view on their future, on the future of their country as they see it from the inside. And I think this is a key component that we should approach through soft measures, through confidence building measures, to make sure that we keep that bond for the generations to come, because at least in the case of Transnistria, Donbas, I don't see that this is something that will come to an end anytime soon. And this means more new generations of people who have never experienced an integrated country.
Yeah, that's a really important point, I think. And James, finally.
2 points. First, Ukraina nie Russia. Ukraine is not Russia, and it's not going to be. Russia and Ukraine do not have a common history. They have an overlapping history, which has bred strong affinities, strong ambivalences, and real antagonism. And that's a reality. The other reality is that this has to be the starting point for Western policy. We are not going to change Russian thinking, which is not all about Putin. The Russia as on so many issues that are important and concern us. Are you there?
Yeah.
Yes. And I'm not demonizing them. They have reasons to have these differences. They're grounded in history. And these differences have to be respected. But our challenge is to live with it, not to try to change Russian thinking, but to live with it intelligently in ways that do not compromise either our own principles or our own interests, or surrender our partners, or return, as Russia wants us to something which will simply cause far greater conflicts in practice, which is a new concert of Europe and sphere of influence carve up in the middle of Europe. This will not end the problem. It will create a much bigger problem.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, I'm always very optimistic about people changing. I hope they will at some point. But thank you all for a really fascinating discussion. We've come to the end of our time. I don't know, Megan, whether you wanted to come in and say anything at this point.
Thank you, Mary. No, just to thank you for chairing and for putting up with your technological problems that meant you were just a minute too late. So for any of our audience who didn't catch my message, but thank you so much for your chairing. It's been superb.
No, well, thank you so much for putting this all together. And I hope we can do it again sometime.